Let's begin. With a statement that our sages made in Maseches Tainis Daf Lamed, the end, close to the end of Tainis. Kol Hamisabil Al Yerushalayim Zoyche V'Roye B'Simchaso. One who mourns for Yerushalayim merits and sees its joy. Grammatically, there's a problem here. We would expect present tense in contrast to future tense, not present tense and then once again present tense. Kol hamisabel al Yerushalayim, whoever mourns on you for Yerushalayim, yiske v'yire b'simchas, will merit to see its joy. That's not what the Gemara says. The Gemara says kol hamisabel al Yerushalayim zoyche v'roye b'simchas. Presently he merits to see the joy, but it's not present. Now he's mourning for Yerushalayim. Now the logic behind the Maimon Chazal we could understand, namely somebody who is with Yerushalayim when it's on a low will be with it when it's on a high. You know, when you're my friend in the hard day, the tough days, then when I make it big, you'll still be my friend. There's people who are only become your friends when you make it big. Some of you know what I'm talking about. But when you're small in the dumps, nobody looks at you. You with your shalayim in the dumps, yiske v'yire b'simchasa, you'll be part of the toyamel, you'll be part of the levyosan party. Got it? But that's yiske in the future, not in the present. This question was raised by the Chassam Sofer. In Drashas Chassam Sofer, I think Chela Gimel Daf Pei Dalet, the Chassam Sofer, who was the Rav of Pressburg. Today Pressburg doesn't exist because the Austro-Hungarian Empire was dissolved during the First World War. Today it's called Bratislava. Chassam Sofer was the Rav of Pressburg and one of the leading figures of Austro-Hungarian Jewry at the time. He passed away in 1839. Tovkov Tzadik Tes. It's good. People quote Chassam Sofer all the time. They don't know when he lived. Chassam Sofer passed away in 1839. Tovkov Tzadik Tes. In the Rosh Chassam Sofer, he asks this question. And he gives a very, very powerful and moving answer in one paragraph. But to give context to the answer of the Chassam Sofer, and to give it a little more understanding for us, to make it a little more flavorable for us, tasty for us, let me change the subject and move on to something else. Also Yerushalayim, but not this Maimon Chazal. It's a story in Maseches Brachos, Daf Chaf Ches Amud Beis. Gemara tells a story. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai fell ill. Kishacholo Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. Who was Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai? Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai is one of the most important figures in Jewish history, not only because he was a Tana, but Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai is the man who observes and makes the transition between what historians like to call Temple Judaism and post-Temple Judaism. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai is the man who observes the destruction of the second Beis Hamikdash. The leader of the Sanhedrin at the time is Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel. Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel is murdered by the Romans. He's the first of the Asar Aruge Malchus, who we read about today. Arzei Halavonoin, Adirei HaTorah, Balei Treisin, B'Mishno, B'Gemara. The 10 Jews, the greatest of the sages, who were tortured and murdered by the Romans after the Churban. The first was Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel, whose father was Rabbi Gamliel. Zedah came from the house of Hillel. Hillel Hazaka, this was the family of Beis David. Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel is murdered, he's beheaded. Rabbi Shmuel Kohen Gadol, the Kohen Gadol at the end of Bayesheni, takes his head, we just read today, places his eyes by his eyes, his mouth on his mouth, and kisses the head, the corpse of Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel until his skin is flayed. Rabbi Shmuel Kohen Gadol, the second one of the Sarig Malchus. Who should have been the next Nasi? His son. Shimon ben Gamliel had a son, Rabbi Gamliel. But he was a baby, he was a child. Tosfos says in Beitza he was a child. So who took over the leadership? Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai did not support the revolt against the Romans. He felt that they had to negotiate with the Romans because they were too powerful. And the Kanoim, the Zealots, did not let anybody leave Jerusalem, but because of a relative relationship, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, the Gemara in Gittin, was sneaked out as a dead body from Yerushalayim. And he meets Vespasian, Aspasianus, who then was the commanding general of the Roman legions in Judea because the emperor was Nero. But Nero disappears. There's two versions. The Roman history is he committed suicide. The Gemara says he converted. And Aspasianus Vespasian becomes the emperor, the Caesar. And Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai meets him before he becomes the Caesar, and he impresses him so much, he asks him to name his requests because he will fulfill them. Imagine, you're a Jew and you name your requests. So Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai asks for three things. He wants a doctor for Reb Tzadik who fasted for 40 years. He wants Reb Gamliel's family to be speared so the Davidic dynasty should not be obliterated. The third thing he wants is Vespasian should tend li Yavne v'chachamel. He should spear Yavne, which is a city maybe 10-15 miles from Jerusalem, which was the center of the yeshiva of the Beis Medrash. Vespasian gives him the request. This is Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. The Gemara says, the Mishnah says in Sukkah, of the Mishnahs, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai was the one who instituted many takanas for the Jews. Zeichel Mikdash, for example, shaking lulav 7 days of Sukkahs, because we only shook lulav the first day. The Beis HaMikdash, they shook 7 days. Outside of the Beis HaMikdash, you shake one day. Lekachtem lachem bayoyim harishon. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai instituted that all Jews in the whole world should shake lulav for 7 days, as we do, to remember the Beis HaMikdash. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai had to create a Yiddishkeit that would survive without its spiritual epicenter, without a Beis HaMikdash, without independent, without autonomy, without political sovereignty, without military sovereignty, without a commonwealth, without an entity, a national entity. Jews are no more a nation in the classical sense of a nation, meaning you have a homeland and you live in your homeland. The homeland is under Rome and they were either massacred or enslaved. This is Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. He falls ill, back to Brachas Chof Ches. He falls ill and his students come to visit him. He's an old man, and he's crying. Students say, Rebbe, why are you weeping? They expected, he's sick, it hurts, he has a stomachache, he has a headache, it hurts, he's crying. They knew it was something more, and he said, how can I not cry? When one comes to the next world, there's two paths, the path to Gan Eden, the path to Gehenna, and purgatory, and ve'eini yedeya be'eze derech me'lichnais. I don't know which path they're going to lead me towards. Gan Eden or Gehenna. Ve'heich lo yefka. How can I not weep? So he's crying. Moments before his death, he turns to the same students and he says, Panu makam, make a place for whom? Chizkiyah melech Yehuda. Chizkiyah, the king of Judea, is coming to escort me on my final journey. Make space for him. And Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai passes on. That's the story of Maseches Brachas Chof Ches. People for generations were startled by the story. Humility does not mean being delusional and false. If somebody is tall and they say, I'm short, it's not humility, it's stupidity. If somebody is brilliant and they say they're dumb, it's not humility, it's stupidity. If somebody has a great talent at something and they deny it, that's not humility. That's being in denial, it's fake humility. Did Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai really think he's going to Gehenna? To quote another Gemara in Brachas, when Rabbi said he's a Beinoni, Abaye said, Lo shavik mar chaya l'chol beria. You're not letting anybody live. If you're not going to Gan Eden, who is Gan Eden made for? The Gemara says Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai lived 120, 40 years he learned, 40 years he taught, and 40 years pirnes es Yisrael, he mentored the Jewish people. He is the man who dedicated his entire life selflessly for Torah and for Am Yisrael. Did he really think that he's going to burn in purgatory when he comes up to heaven? Was that his level of self-perception? Why did he think? Would he think, who's Gan Eden made for if not him? Put it simply, if he's going to Gehenna, who's not going to Gehenna? Might as close down the Gan Eden. I mean, there's an old joke that this saint comes to heaven and he goes to paradise. So God says, it's dinner time. He says, great. Hashem opens a can of sardines and gives him sardines. He didn't think this is what not how they described in the Musa Shmuz and what Gan Eden was like. For breakfast, a tuna, a can of tuna. For lunch, it was a jar of gefilte fish. Remember the jars of gefilte fish? For dinner, it was again sardines. He decided to go check the other side, you know. So he goes to Gehenim and he gets a shmek from the outside. I'm a chayis, Chinese, Japanese, Thai, French, Italian. It was areyach Gan Eden, but it was areyach Gehenim. So he comes back to the Rebbeinu Shel Olam and he says, you know, I thought I'm in Gan Eden. Sardines, tuna fish. God says, does it really pay to cook for one person? Doesn't really do. You know what I mean? You have to know where the action is, where the people are. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai says he's going to Gehenim. He's going to Gehenim, so really, so who's not going to Gehenim? What's this thing? He's going to Gehenim. Come on. He knew who he was. He knew what type of life he lived. That's where he's ending up in. Strange story, difficult story. The truth is, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai was onto something very profound. You know, sometimes, this is nice, almost like drinking. The earth is drinking. So if you could become one with earth, you can also take a little bit of the water in. The nucleus of this insight, although it's going to be developed a little bit, Be'ezer Hashem, is in the work Chumash Drashas by Rabbi Yashaber, Rabbi Yashaber Soloveitchik. And I'll develop it a little bit, but the nucleus is his. The nucleus of the idea of the inside is this. Let's think about it for a moment. You have many people who live wonderful lives, noble lives, moral lives, ethical lives. But there's one thing that happened in their life that sits on them, and they don't forgive themselves for it. Yiddish Imamas, Yiddish Ababas know this very, very well. Sometimes you lived a wonderful life, but there's one thing you did, you said, you didn't do, you didn't say. And for the rest of your life, that sits on your conscience, and you regret it. They say the definition of a Jew is that if he doesn't feel guilty, he blames himself. There were two women who went for jury duty. A Jewish woman, she got off of their jury duty, and the reason is, because she told the judge that she was guilty. So, sometimes you live a good life, but at the end of your life, there's one thing that sits on your chest. And in a moment of truth, it comes out. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai knew about what type of life he lived. Not only exemplary, but extraordinary, saintly. Literally from the G'dayli Hadar, the Nasi of the Sanhedrin, the head of the Sanhedrin, the highest spiritual seat in the Jewish nation. And he was succeeded by Rabbi Gamliel, his predecessors, Yosem. Rabbi Gamliel was succeeded by Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. You're dealing with the top, la creme de la creme spiritually. But there was one moment in his life that Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai could not forgive himself for. This ate up on him, and before he died, he reflected on it. It was the moment he stood face to face with the Roman top general, Vespasian, soon to become the Caesar. And the man said, Rabbi, I'll do whatever you want. Tell me what you want. He chose three things: a doctor for a tzaddik, spear one family, and preserve Yavna, preserve the Beis Medrash, preserve the Yeshiva, preserve the Sanhedrin, don't burn it down, don't destroy it, which Vespasian did. He followed through with his pledge. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai asked himself, did I make not only the mistake of a lifetime, but the mistake that ultimately transformed Jewish history? Why? Because the most powerful person in the world is asking you to name your request. Could have I not asked for the Beis HaMikdash? Could have I not asked for Yerushalayim? Could have I not asked Vespasian make a U-turn and go back to Rome? And maybe he would have done it. In fact, no less a man like Rabbi Akiva, no less a man like Rabbi Yosef, the Gemara says in Gittin in the fifth Perek, mocked Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, I shouldn't say mocked, ridiculed, or felt very sour, felt negatively about what he did. Rabbi Yosef and Rabbi Akiva read a pasuk about him.
a pasuk we said last night, Meshiv Chachamim Ocher. Sometimes the Ribbono Shel Olam takes the wisdom of the sages and he turns it backwards. How could Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai have been given such an opportunity and squandered it? The man loves you. The man cherishes you. The man will do whatever you tell him. Ask for the Beis HaMikdash, for heaven's sake. Tell him, you know what, we're sorry, just go back home. Leave us alone. Maybe he would have done it. Is it possible that because of you, indirectly, Jerusalem was destroyed, the Beis HaMikdash was torched, the Jewish people were exiled for a long Golus Edad that we're still dealing with, we're still in, all because of you? Now, of course, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai meant well. Tafasta meruba loy tafasta. You can't ask for too much. We'll throw you out of the office. So he asked for Yavna. He asked for Tzadik. He thought that would be accepted. That was his cheshbon. But was he right? And you know, how many of us have a chance in history to be asked a question that is going to change history? The question is not, when are you coming home? That may also change history. The question is not, when are you leaving the house already? There was once a woman, she was trying to cook for Shabbos. It was a short Friday, 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And he's in the kitchen, you know, when a husband lands in the kitchen, he's tasting, Tayamel, like we spoke before. He's tasting from every dish. The problem is there was nothing ready yet, but he's tasting. So she looks at him and she says, you know, do you have to right now be in the kitchen? It's Friday afternoon. I mean, why don't you help me out? So he says, of course, honey, how can I help you out? She says, leave the house. So he leaves the house, he goes to shul, he does Shnaya Mikra Vecha Targum for an hour and a half, a slow Maiva Sedra. And then he comes home, back in the kitchen, looks for the kugel. She says, what now? He says, Vifel is Ashir Helfen. How long can I help you? I already helped you an hour and a half. Sometimes you ask questions that are not necessarily historic. But once in a while, you're asked a question and you know this is going to determine history. You know when Eichmann offered Rabbi Weissmandl, Michal Ber Weissmandl, 1 million Hungarian Jews, 800,000 Hungarian Jews in 1944, right? And Rabbi Weissmandl never forgave himself till the end of his life, even though it was not his fault, but he blamed himself for 800,000 Hungarian Jews that the Germans were ready to release for $2 million, and it was sabotaged. Rabbi Weissmandl never recovered. He went to Mount Kisco, he built a yeshiva, he wrote his Sforim. He never forgave himself. It wasn't his fault. But he felt that 1 million Jews died, including his own family. He jumped out from the train, broke his hand, broke his leg. He survived, but nobody else survived. Not his mishpacha, not his wife, not his children. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai asked himself that question. Maybe I ultimately betrayed my people in a moment of truth. I could have told us, Pasyonis, ten li Yerushalayim, ten li Beis HaMikdash. I didn't. I went for the small thing. I went for Yavna. Maybe, ultimately, I am guilty. You know where I belong? I belong in Gehenna. And how? Now, you know, you're facing Vespasian. He says, what do you want? What do you do at that moment? You open a Nigris Moshe. You open a Shutcham Seifer. You open a Shutcham Bekiveger. You open Shalsat Shuvas Achiezer from Reb Chaim Moshe. You can't call your rabbi. Even if you would be able to call your rabbi from the office of Vespasian, I'm not sure your rabbi would have an answer. In which siman in Shulchan Aruch does it tell you what to tell the Roman Caesar when he asks you what you want? Where are you going to look it up? In which siman in Yoredeya? In which siman in Chosha Mishpat? In which Prima Godim? In which Taz? In which Smeh? In which Ktsos? In which Nesivis are you going to look up what to tell the Roman Caesar when he asks you? These are questions that don't say in the books. How do you answer these questions? You have to answer these questions with your kishkas. You have to answer these questions with your gut. You have to answer these questions with something that is beyond what says clearly in the book. You have to answer this question with 2,000 years of experience. You have to answer these questions with a certain Ruach HaKodesh, with a certain inspiration that's not clearly in the book. It doesn't say anywhere. There's no Tosfos that tells you what to tell Aspasianus. There's no Rashbin, there's not even a Bircha Shmuel that will answer this question. So what do? You answer with your kishkas. And he answered, ten li yavna v'chachama. And before his death, he told himself, maybe I am ultimately a criminal. He couldn't answer the question. He couldn't. How would he know? He died just a few years after the destruction. How would he know? How would he know if he was the greatest hero of Jewish history or a great villain of Jewish history? If he's going to Gan Eden or he's going to Gehenna, how would he know? He couldn't know. But right before he dies, people see things. And he said, make space for Chizkiah Melech Yehuda. Why Chizkiah? Why not Avraham Avinu? Why not Moshe? Why not David? Why not Shlomo? Why not another person? Why not Shimon HaTzadik? Why from all people? Chizkiah Melech Yehuda. Why from him? He appears to welcome Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai to the next world. Here, Rabbi Yosha Ber didn't say this part. He said till this part. But here, I believe, lay the second half of this drama, the second half of the story. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai could not know. But we are living 1,900 years after Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. They once asked a Chinese politician, what is your view of the French Revolution and American Revolution? And he said, too early to tell. What's 250 years? Baby steps, 250 years. But we have perspective. We have perspective. It's one unique quality that the Jewish people have. We don't always use our perspective, because for that you have to look into the rear view mirror. And some of us don't believe that you're allowed to look into the rear view mirror. But if you look into the rear view mirror, we have perspective. 1,900 years ago, he faced Vespasian and he said, four words, Ten li yavne v'chachama. And now I change the subject again, as I always say for those who are ADD, especially on Tisha B'Av, no need to worry. You could follow me because I never stick to one subject for more than a few minutes. I am on your team. I know what it's like. I know what it's like. I am on your team. I'm not only a sympathizer, I'm an empathizer. I'm with you in the abyss. So I went from the Samsoi for Tainis to Yochanan ben Zakkai in Brachas, and now I take you to January 1961. McGill University in Montreal, in the Hillel House, McGill University, Montreal, January 61, Tovshin Chaf, for those who are more familiar with those numbers, a public debate between two people. One, a British historian, and the other, a Talmud Chacham, an ambassador, a scholar, and a great man. On one side sits Professor Arnold Toynbee. Arnold Toynbee is a British historian, a world-renowned historian at the time, who did not like Jews. And if you follow Oxford politics today, you know that the Toynbees still don't like Jews. His grandchildren have something with the Jewish people, and never mind with Israel. There's Zayda, Salahabin Alichtik, and whatever. I could probably answer the question of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai for him, but I won't. His Zayda, there's Zayda, I don't know if called Zayda, Professor Toynbee was no Philo Semite. He had something with Jews. He spoke calmly, deliberately. He was a great scholar, no question. One of the world-renowned historians of his day, an author of many works and many books. But a bone to pick with the Jewish people, I still don't know why. On the other side sat Rabbi Dr. Yaakov Herzog, Jacob Herzog. He was a son of Rabbi Yitzchak Isaac Halevi Herzog, was one of the Gaonei Hador, succeeded Rav Kook as the second chief rabbi of Eretz Yisrael. He was a Talmud of Rabbi Isser Zalman Meltzer, the Oven Ha'abal Oven Ha'elzel, the Rosh Yeshiva of Eitz Chaim in Slutsk, the father-in-law of Reb Aaron Kotler. Reb Isser Zalman Meltzer was a Talmud of Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, Reb Chaim Briska in Valozhin. Reb Yaakov Herzog was a serious Talmud Muvusk of his. He was the brother of Chaim Herzog, who would become another president of Israel and would tear up the famous document in 1975 in the UN. His nephew is Yitzchak Herzog, Buzi Herzog, who's today the leader of the opposition. Yaakov Herzog died a young man, wrote a very interesting book called Am Levadat Yishkan, A Nation That Dwells Alone, a good read. Died very young. He was a great scholar. He was the ambassador of Israel to Canada for years, and he was a pemapik. He is a beautiful mouth, talented man. Unfortunately, was taken very young. This is Rabbi Herzog, Rabbi Yaakov Herzog, or Dr. Herzog. He debates Toynbee. The debate focused on two different topics. One was the situation in Israel and the Arabs, 1961. So this is at the time when Gaza was under Egyptian domain. Okay? East Jerusalem and the West Bank under Yehuda and Shamron, under Jordan control. Golan Heights under Syrian control. Israel then is a tiny, tiny, it's still a tiny country, but then it's mamish a tiny country the size of Dallas International Airport. Mamish a tiny country, at some point 9 miles in its width. 9 miles, Rabbi Say, a country surrounded by enemies. 9 miles. 9 miles. You know what 9 miles is? It's a joke. Forche. And college, whatever it is. I mean, I don't know the cheshbonus here. But from Brooklyn, I used this. But this is the state in 1961. And he says that the Israelis are like the Nazis. What the Nazis did to the Jews, they are doing to that, which we still hear constantly, nonstop. Herzog spoke. But then there was a second topic, Jewish history. Toynbee decided that Jews are a crazy people. That, we don't disagree with them. We know it's maybe better than he. But, by him, it's in a different way. I'm going to explain to you. He had a very comfortable theory that was based on, if you're familiar, Hegel, that every nation, every empire goes through three stages. It rises, it reaches its plateau, it declines, thesis, then antithesis, and the whole process how it works. With the Jewish nation, he didn't see this. They rise, they reach a plateau, they decline, they almost die, they come back. They rise, they die again. And he couldn't figure out how this fits in elegantly to his theory of how every nation, every empire, every culture, every civilization functions. And he decided that the Jewish people, you can't call them dead, but you also can't call them alive. So therefore, what do you call them? He gave us a name. Fossils. We are fossils. Fossils of history, that's the Jewish people. The fossils are not dead, but they're not alive. They're fossils. He naturally didn't feel that Jews have a very strong right to the land of Israel. There's no continuous nation. Besides the fact Jews are not a real, they're not a nation. They're a culture. They're a religion. A nation is entitled to a homeland. A culture is not entitled to a homeland. Christianity, Islam, these are religions. You have Australian Christians and you have British Christians, you have American Christians, you have American Jews, you have French Jews, British Jews, Italian Jews, Russian Jews. They're all the same Jews. They're not a nation, they're an idea, a religion. Wherever you are, you still have the religion. This was his argument. Where do they have a homeland? They're fossils. Professor Herzog responded to him briefly, concisely. The first time I heard about the debate was reviewed by Rabbi Yisrael Meir Lau, who was then the chief rabbi of Israel. Then I actually heard the actual debate because it was recorded. Rabbi Lau developed well the idea that Herzog responded to Toynbee, and I would like to share it with you and develop it somewhat. The nucleus of the idea is his, but we're going to develop it a little bit. And his presentation to Toynbee consists of the following idea. Imagine that three Olympic airplanes arrive in different regions of our planet. The first airplane lands in Athens, in the country of Greece, Yavon, Griechenland in Yiddish. Who comes out? An old man comes out of that airplane, and he's greeted by one of the people working in the airport, and he asks the old man, who has a long, impressive beard, pointing upward, you could see that he's used his brain, he asks this elderly man, "What is your name?" And the elderly man says, "My name is Socrates." And the man in the airport says, "I never heard of you. Where do you come from?" He says, "You live in Athens and you never heard of Socrates? Shame on you. Take me to the Acropolis." He says, "The Acropolis? For $7.50. I could show you the remnants of the Acropolis." He says, "Okay, take me to worship at Zeus." He says, "Zeus? Nobody worships Zeus anymore." He says, "Who do you worship?" He says, we have the Greek Orthodox Church. Socrates says, what's the Greek Orthodox Church? He says, you don't know what the Orthodox Church is? He says, I don't know. How would Socrates know? Socrates was the teacher of Plato. Plato was the teacher of Aristotle. You're dealing here with the origins of Greek philosophy before the construction of the second Beis HaMikdash, centuries before Yashkala was born. What Greek Orthodox Church? Zeus! Zeus! So what's Greek Orthodox Church? The church? What's the church? So he says, I'll explain it to you. I'll explain to you what the church is briefly. Here is how it works. Every Jewish child who's born in the home of a Jewish mother is made to believe by the mother not only that he is God's gift to humanity, but that he is also God himself. This is what a healthy Jewish mother inculcates in the mind of her child. However, most children grow up and at some point they marry a Jewish wife. Like I said earlier, within a few weeks, usually within a few hours, she makes it clear to him, not only that he's not God, he's not God's gift to humanity, but the question is if he's even a part of humanity and if he's entitled to function as part of humanity. And everything works out, and for the rest of his life, most Jewish men are conflicted between his mother's view of himself and his wife's view of himself, which is why most men are in therapy to try to figure out how to make shalom bayis between what your wife thinks you are and your mother thinks you are. Especially when the shviger agrees with your wife as well. So now you have the issue of achirei rabim lahatos. The majority of women in the world agree with your wife, and your mother is a das yachid, but it's still your mother. But nonetheless, emash gichin babaska. So it's really a very, very difficult issue. There was a bacher once who was dating this girl. It was mamish gevaldik. He liked her, she liked him. But at the end, he comes home, and he wants to do it. He wants to propose, and this he proposes. She says, "I have to think about it." And she comes home to her mother, and she says, "He proposed. What should I do?" She says, "Of course, say yeah, you like him." She says, "One problem. I found out today that unbelievable. He's a shtickle apikiris." She says, "What? What? He looks like an erlich kida, erlich bacher, a brisk mere 9 years. I mean, what do you want? BMG, the works. He doesn't believe in hell. He doesn't believe in Gehenna." Mother says that's not a reason not to marry him. She says, why not? She says, you marry him and between both of us we'll show him it's real. Don't worry about it. We will restore his faith. We'll be machzer atara le'yoshna. Anyway, so this is what happens. So you sit the rest of your life, you have two perspectives on who you are. Mommy says this about me, and the Rebbetzin says this about me. Figure it out. Good luck. The problem with Yashkala was he never got married, and therefore the view of his mother about him remained permanently etched in his heart. And being a charismatic Jew today, there are 2.5 billion people who also believe his mother about who he is. I don't have to be Meirich. Back to Socrates. This is my PhD dissertation about the origins of Christianity and how he managed to convince the world. It's not unique to him. It's every single Jewish kid has the same situation. Either his mother wants him to be Mashiach or God or almost Mashiach or Rabban Shel Kol Bnei Hagoyla or the savior of the world. If not, he got to sit Shiva until he gets married and things straighten out. And that guy never got married. Socrates looks at him and says, okay, now tell me, how is Greek philosophy doing? Greek philosophy. Nobody studies Greek philosophy anymore. You have a few professors who read, he says, people don't read the Republic? No, who reads Greek philosophy? It's obsolete. He says, so what do people talk about in cafes? They talk about iPhone 5, iPhone 6, iPhone 7, iPhone 12, this iPhone, that iPhone. He says, now how is the Greek Empire doing? Says, what empire? Greece has no empire. He says, what is it? He says, it's a country. What type of country? It's a member of NATO struggling to survive financially, doesn't even know its future. He says, you mean the Greek Empire of Alexander the Great is gone? He says, the Greek Empire is gone, my dear friend. For more than 2,400 years, there's no Greek Empire. It's gone. Where have you been? Socrates says, sir, you're telling me that when people hear the name Greece, they don't tremble? He says, sir, they don't tremble. He says, why aren't you speaking in ancient Greek? He says, nobody speaks ancient Greek anymore. He says, take me to worship at Mount Olympus. He says,
says, we don't have a Mount Olympus anymore. We still have nice sports in Rio and other places, but we don't have Mount Olympus. Socrates looks at him and says, this is not my Athens. I'm out of this place. Bye. Another plane, another Olympic airplane lands, this one in Rome. A man walks out of the airplane, a lot of wounds on his chest. You could see he's a warrior, he's a great statesman. He comes down the airplane and a man in the airport greets him and says, welcome to Rome, what is your name? The man says, my name is Julius Caesar. He says, ah, Caesar, from the Caesar salad family. You're the one who made, oh, my wife likes Caesar salad. For me, it's too healthy, but my wife loves Caesar salad. Julius looks at him and says, you know, in the good old days, you could have died for that statement. From the Caesar salad, you're joking? Caesar. I'm the Roman Caesar. Now tell me, who is the Roman Caesar today? He looks at him, he says, Mr. Julius, there has not been a Roman Caesar for close to 2 millennia. In fact, the whole Roman Empire has dissolved. You could thank your friend Constantinople for it. The whole Roman Empire is gone. He says, you mean Rome is not the dominant force in humanity today? He says, no. He says, so what's Rome? He says, it's a city in Italy. He says, what's Italy? A member of NATO. What's NATO? He gives him a lecture about NATO. He says, take me to the Colosseum. He says, for $8, I'll show you its remnants. Take me to the Senate. I want to stand again at the steps of the Senate where those fateful words I said were uttered. E tu, Brute. Then Caesar falls. He says, there's no Senate and there's no steps of the Senate. Take me to my gladiator. For $6.75, I'll show you the remnants. Take me to my gymnasiums. They're gone. Why don't you speak Latin? Nobody speaks Latin today, a few intellectuals. What do you speak? Italian. What are you known for today? He says, peace, pizza and pasta. He says, take me to worship at Jupiter. He says, we don't worship Jupiter. What do you worship? He says, we have the Vatican. He says, what's the Vatican? He says, Catholicism. What's Catholicism? Christianity. Julius Caesar, what in the world is Christianity? He says, let me explain it to you. There was a little boy. His name was Yashkala. His mother told him that he was God, like every Jewish mother. You know my thesis, most boys get married at some point. He never got married, and he continued to believe what his mother told him about himself. That's who they still worship. Julius Caesar looks at him and says, this is not my Rome. I am out of here. Goodbye. He leaves. A third airplane lands, not in Athens and not in Rome, Ben Gurion Airport in Tel Aviv. An old man walks out of the airplane. Somebody in the airport comes up to greet him. He tells him two words in Hebrew. Shalom Aleichem. The old man says, Aleichem Shalom. He looks at the old man and he says, Mashimcha, what is your name? The old man says, Shmi Moshe. My name is Moshe. And the other man starts jumping and gets excited. Gam ani Moshe! Ani Moshe mitibilisi, Georgia, ani pokvar shmonach adashim, asiti aliyayim nefesh ben nefesh, and they already ripped me off. Where are you from, Moshe? And he says, I'm from Egypt. Ani noladeti b'mitzrayim. I'm from Egypt. He says, what brings you here, Moshe? He says, I came home. He says, have you ever been here before? He says, no, I've never been here before. So why do you call it home? He says, trust me, I worked very hard to get here. I worked very hard. I almost got in. Almost. I'm allowed to call it home. I sacrificed enough for this country. I sacrificed enough to bring the people close to this homeland. I could call it my home. Young Moshe from Tbilisi looks at old Moshe from Egypt and he says, Bruchim Abayim, welcome home. Old man Moshe looks at him and says, I have an awkward question for you. My friend Socrates and Julius Caesar were in a rush. They thought they're going to find treasures in Athens and Rome. So they really took off very fast. I forgot something and I really need it. Do you think anybody has it? He says, what? What do you need? We have everything here. We have everything. We have what you need. We have what you don't need. We have what you want. We have what you don't want. What do you need? Moshe says, I need something called talis and tefillin. You think anybody here has tallis and tefillin? The young man looks at him and says, now I'm not starting to like you. Now you're getting on my nerves. Now I see the holier than thou syndrome. Does anybody have tallis and tefillin? How dare you? Ani achshav inachti tefillin pabes de tufa yesh bet chabad. They hijack you. They wrap tefillin on your head. Look, the straps all over. I just did it. What matter metal tefillin? You go in there. You think you're the only religious Jew, the only one who has tallis and tefillin. Everybody here has tallis and tefillin. Of course you can have. He goes, wow, amazing. He says, one more question. In heaven, there's not a lot of food. I know from experience, I was there 40 days. They serve nothing. Nothing. Nada, they serve nothing. I am starving. It's been a long time since I had a meal. You think there's food in Israel? He says, food? They don't stop eating. That is the definition of Jewish life for many Jews. They don't stop eating. And every holiday is the same message. They try to kill us, we won, let's go eat. Pesach, Shavuos, Sukkos, Lag BaOmer, Tu B'Shvat, Purim, Erev Chanukah, Matzoy Tisha B'Av, Erev Tisha B'Av. They try to kill us, we won, it's time to eat. Let's wash. Of course, Moshe says, you don't understand. I'm awkward again. I have a weird diet. You think they have it here? He says, what type of diet? He says, kosher. Kosher. Here you go again. Ata choshev shata acharedi ayachid shemamin ve'elokim ata dati ayachid kulam davar acher chutzpah shalcha. You are racist. You're chauvinistic. You are a bigot. You know how many koshers there are? In this airport itself, there are approximately 91 restaurants. And 80% of them, 90% of them are kosher. And every type of kosher. We have Rabbanut Mahadim, we have Mahadim in Mahadim, we have Badat Eda Charedis, we have Badat Rabbi Landau, we have Glat, we have Semi-Glat, we have kosher style, we have Australian kosher, Japanese kosher, Thai kosher, Italian kosher, every type of kashrus. Everything you have. Wow. Moshe comes down. And now, Moshe says, there's a place to put on talis and tefillin. He says, one place. Every type of conceivable shul we have. Ashkenaz, Sfaradi, Duta Mizrach, Teiman, Arizal, Nakdishach, Nekadesh, Keser. Hybrid between Nakdishach and Nekadesh. Almost Keser when he's in a good mood, Nakdishach, a bad mood, Keser, Nekadesh, everything. Singing, no singing, depressed, fast, slow, very slow. Vasikin, koil chatzois, before vasikin, mishayakir, after vasikin, late, early, out. We have everything here. Every nusach, every version you want. They come into a room, and Moshe looks at the door, and he says, what's this on the door? The young man says, now you should be ashamed. This is called a mezuzah. What is it? Get an education. 3,000 years ago, there was a man, Moshe, who gave these portions to the Jews and told them to hang it on their doors. We kiss them. Then he says, now let me show you a Jewish school. And he takes him into a cheder, Talmud Torah, a school, and the teacher is sitting with the children. They open up a chumash, and the teacher looks at the kids and says, say after me, word for word. And he says loud, Vayedaber Adonai el Moshe le'mor. And two large pearls, which we call tears, stream down the two cheeks of Moshe Rabbeinu as he watches the students and the teacher reading together the text of whether it was Parshas Shmini or Parshas Kedoshim or Parshas Ekev. Herzog looks at Toynbee and he says, Professor Toynbee, I ask you a question. Socrates, the greatest of ancient Greek philosophers, comes back to Athens today. What does he encounter? Not the same language, not the same culture, not the same philosophy, not the same faith, not the same values, not the same God, not the same traditions, not the same belief system, not the same lifestyle day to day. And yet, Professor Toynbee, in your books, you always refer to the Greeks, you always refer to the Italians as nations, real nations.
If Julius Caesar comes back to Rome today, what does he find? Not the same reality, not the same culture, language, philosophy, structures, belief system, God, deity, nothing. Rome, Italy is a nation. Greece is a nation. If Moses comes back today, with all of the challenges, with all of the problems, he walks into the Holy Land today. You know what he finds? You know what he encounters? Jews who speak the same language, who worship the same gods, who do the same mitzvahs, who have the same text, who have the same Torah scroll, the same Sefer Torah, who follow the identical traditions. They still blow the same ram's horn that they blew in his time. It gave migraine headaches then, and it gives migraine headaches today. The same lulav that they shook then, they're still shaking. The same stale matzah that they ate 3,300 years ago in the desert, they're still eating, and you could sense that it's the same matzah. It's stale now like it was stale then. And they all say, it's delicious. The matzah this year is delicious. Of course, they don't mean it. I'm still waiting for somebody to serve matzah at their daughter's wedding. If it's so delicious, let's see it on the smorgasbord. Instead of the sushi. Instead of the baby spear ribs. Let's see matzah. Nobody. At the Seder, in a crisis, delicious. Like on a plane, you say the food is delicious. If your wife would serve you airplane food, you would go for a get. Because the green beans are at a bar mitzvah age, and the rice is bas mitzvah, and the chicken is already retired. And frozen. But it's delicious. But it's the same matzah. Even if they're complaining, it's the same matzah. The same Shabbos. The same exact tzitzis. The same mezuzahs. The same tefillin, the same text of the Sefer Torah, the same Yom Kippur, the same Sukkah, the same Schach. The same arguments, the same problems, and the same Ribbono Shel Olam. Exactly the same. Julius Caesar comes to Rome, he recognizes almost nothing. Socrates comes to Athens, he recognizes almost nothing. Moshe comes to Eretz Yisrael, he recognizes almost everything. Including the fighting. Just from the Chumash, straight off the Chumash. Professor Toynbee, I ask you now. Greece is a nation. Italy is a nation. Israel is not a nation. The Jewish people are not a nation. Professor Toynbee, if Israel is not a nation, when 3,000 years later he would still feel comfortable and at home, he and David and Shlomo and Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai and Bekoichva, it's not a nation. You tell me, what is a nation, Professor Toynbee? What is a nation? To his credit, he said he has to think about it. He's still thinking. And a similar interesting argument was used by not a very yeshivish Jew. Yaakov Herzog was a Talmud Chacham, a Talmud Rabbi Zalman Meltzer, the Evan Ozel on the Rambam. But another Jew. Very different. But he used argument. I should say he probably would have been closer to Judaism if not for his Rebbetzin. Levitson was a real tzatzka. 1937, the Peel Commission. Lord Peel was a British minister. Palestine, Eretz Yisrael was called Palestine. It's a name of the Romans. The Romans changed the name from Judea to Palestine to add insult to injury and remind the Jews that the Philistines, the Plishtim, were here before them. And it's knowing that Yasser Arafat, who of course won the Nobel Peace Prize, told Bill Clinton b'shaite, Bill Clinton is the Rebbetzin of Hillary Clinton, told Bill Clinton b'shaite that he comes from the Plishtim. You hear Arafat's chiddush? He comes from the Plishtim. The Jews took away the land from the Plishtim. And there was no temple on the Temple Mount. And even Bill Clinton said, what do you mean? Everybody knows there was a temple on the Temple Mount. Almost instinctively, he said. Arafat said there was nothing on the Temple Mount. Because the Arabs have a chush. They know how to lie, be'emes. Jews don't even know how to say emes with emes. When we say the land is ours, we stammel, we stutter. They know how to lie with a straight face, mitan emes. It's moiridik. You ever watch Hanan Ashrawi, how she lies? She could tell you now it's 2 o'clock a.m. and CNN and ABC and CBS will be mesmerized. The eloquence. It's 2 o'clock a.m. and the blood fishing in 1937. There are major pogroms in Eretz Yisrael, and this is before there's a settlement. This is before 67. This is before there's a Jewish state. There's major pogroms and the British are in charge. They have a mandate over Palestine. They took it from the Turks because of the First World War, 1914. The Turks lost Eretz Yisrael. There was no Turkish Empire anymore. It goes over to the British. What do we do with the Jews and the Arabs? They make a commission. Who testifies before the Peel Commission? David Ben-Gurion, who would be later the first Prime Minister. Ben-Gurion turns to the commission and he says, when did the Mayflower boat arrive at Plymouth Rock here, not here, arrive in America? And of course they know it's in the 1620? Huh? 1620? Okay, let's get some graduates from Kiryas Yoel. When did the Mayflower arrive? Because these people didn't have a real education. Huh? It's a moving truck. Listen, people who have to compensate for a lack of education know much more than people that went through the system. It's a fact. It's a fact. How do you think I know a little English? I'm not going to tell you about my education right now. We're not going to do all confessions in one day. So, Mayflower arrived in the 1620s. So this is 1937, so we're dealing with 300 years earlier. He says, can anybody tell me which day did it take leave? Which day did it come to the port? How many people were there? What food did they eat? And who was the leader? Here you have ministers, politicians, educated people. What food did they eat on the Mayflower? How many people were on it? What day did it come? What day did it leave port in Britain? Nobody knows. So this is 300 years ago. I'm going to tell you about an event that happened 3,000 years ago. Every Jewish child that grew up in a Jewish home or a Jewish environment, ask him, what food did the Hebrew slaves eat when they went on their Mayflower, when they left Egypt? How many Jews left Egypt? He'll give you the number. Who was the leader? He'll give you his name. What day in the month was it? He'll tell you the month and he'll tell you the day. Says, this is our people. They asked him, what's your deed for the book? What's your deed? So he picks up the Tanakh. He says, this is our deed. Now one day Rabbi Lau confronted Ben-Gurion and he says to him, imagine somebody takes the deed and tramples it. How serious would people take the deed? Ben-Gurion, don't you realize your mistake? This is your deed, but you trampled on it. That's a separate conversation, a separate story between him and Ben-Gurion that I once heard from Rabbi Lau. So Toynbee understood Herzog's argument. Now, I go back to Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. I changed the subject. I didn't digress. I extrapolated. Do you understand what I said? I didn't digress. I extrapolated. Just like the Gemara. You never digress. You just extrapolate. At some point, you got to come back. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai did not know the answer to the question. He did not know. However, I don't want to go into Metzoy Tisha B'Av. If Vu Halta Zege. 7:10. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai could not know. But we could know.
because we're living 1,900 years later. And now we answer the question, did Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai deserve to go to Gan Eden, or did he deserve to go to Gehenna? Well, the answer is very clear, and the answer is simple and straightforward. Rome ruled the world for 500 years, but the question is today, where is Julius Caesar? Where is Vespasian? Where is Titus? Where is Caligula? Where is Pompey? Where is Nero? Where is Adrian? Where is Constantine? Where is Nerva? Where is Domitian? Titus' brother who built Shar Titus, where are they? The answer is they are all in Wikipedia. You could look it up as I speak. Put in Titus, Wikipedia Titus. Now I ask you, we are the Jewish people. The answer, we created Wikipedia. As we created Waze, Google, and a few other small companies. So the question is, how did that happen? In his famous article, very famous article in Harper magazine in the late 1890s, Mark Twain wrote this famous article, where are the Egyptians? Where are the Assyrians? Where are the Babylonians? Where are the Greek? Where are the Persian? Where are the Romans? Where are the Byzantines? They are all in the dustbin of history. You ever went to Century 21 and you met somebody and said, hi, who are you? And he said, I'm Paris Anakel. Or I'm from Nebuchadnezzar's family. Or I belong to Titus. Or I'm from the old Plishtim. Or I'm from the old Yevonim. You know the Chanukah latkes? I belong to the other side. I never saw in Home Depot. Home Depot, you don't meet a lot of Jews. Because Jews hire somebody to do the work. How much place do Jews give in an average Jewish home? How much place do you have for a hammer and nails? It's usually in the kitchen drawer. You have a hammer, you have a few nails. A Gentile, Baruch Hashem, you build a second house, you come to Muncie to have for tools. Second house for tools. To fix tires and this. It's a whole different situation. But who owns Home Depot? And it's not a joke. So Mark Twain wanted to understand this. How did it happen? Mark Twain wasn't Jewish. When he met Shalom Aleichem, you know, Mark Twain met Shalom Aleichem. So Mark Twain looks at Shalom Aleichem and he says, they say you're the Yiddish Mark Twain. He says, no, you're the Goyish of Shalom Aleichem. He finishes the article, what's their secret to the immortality of the Jew? Good question. Nobody knows. Toynbee says we're fossils. You can't get rid of us, but we're not fully alive. We're not fully alive, we're not fully dead. We're fossils. What? Nobody knows how it happened. Because according to the system of all nations, you have your time, you have your limit, and then you expire. Everyone dies. Everything mortal dies. Bear Stern died. Lehman Brothers died. The Titanic, the unsinkable ship, sadly and tragically, the Titanic. I don't want to say, but even Coca-Cola one day, and even the Yankees, they should have a Riches Yamat be as Goel Tzedek, but nothing that a human being creates lasts forever. It's Binyan Debar Nash. What's the secret? Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai knew the answer. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai looked Vespasian in the eye. Now you imagine, here you have the most powerful person in the world, Vespasian, no question, Caesar of Rome. All the roads were leading to Rome. And here you have a man representing a nation that is soon going to be almost completely dead. And Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai is asked for three things. He's given three offers. And he had his eyes fixed, not on now, he had his eyes fixed on eternity. And he knew one thing. He knew that as long as Yavna, the Chachameha, exists, the Jewish people won't die. Without a Beis HaMikdash, maybe they'll live, maybe they won't. Without bringing a Karban Tumet every morning and every afternoon, without bringing a Karban Musaf every Shabbos, every Rosh Chodesh, every Yom Tov,
without the avoid of Kabbalah Saddam, Zvika Saddam, without the avoid of Menachis of Kmitza, without the avoid of Yom Kippurim, without Achilles Kotchim, without Achilles Karban Pesach, without all of the avoidus of the Beis HaMikdash on a daily basis, Jews may survive, Jews may not survive. But one thing he knew for sure, the moment the Jews stop learning about the Beis HaMikdash, the moment they won't only not be makriv the Talmud, they won't be able to learn zvachim and nachas, chulim, pchayrus, erkin, tmurah, krisis. The moment the concepts of me'ilah, Talmud, midas, kinim will be taken away from them. The moments kilayim, trumas, meiser, shvias, and meiser, sheni will go over their bookshelf, they won't learn it anymore. He knew now for sure they won't survive. This is their link to God, and therefore it's their link to eternity. So when he said, Yavna v'chachamel, he had his eyes fixed on eternity. He knew that in the long term, he is making Vespasian do something that is ultimately undermining Rome. Poor Vespasian, by agreeing to spare Yavna v'chachamel, he didn't realize he was helping the Jew defeat Rome in the long term. Was Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai right? Look in the mirror today. You know, Kinnis is a depressing book. But every year when I finish the Kinnis, and I always cry by many of the Kinnis, I always think it's not going to happen when I read the story of Rabbi Shmuel Kohen Gadol's son and daughter when they hugged each other and they died hugging each other. And the story of the Asar Rugi Malchus. And the various stories, Yeshiyahu HaMelech with the 300 arrows. It's a very sad book to read. You go, if you know a little bit of the history, you go through the stages. And then I read the poems at the end about the Holocaust from Reb Michal Ber Weissmandel, from Reb Shimon Schwab, from the Baba Virov, and from others who made it. I read it at the end. And then we do Elitzion. And then I close the book of Kinnis, but I always think to myself, it's a depressing book. But look, I remember every one of the children that Nivuzrada murdered to atone for the blood of Schaya Hanavi. Yes, there were 9 kabim of brain on one stone, 300 corpses hanging on the branch of one tree. But I remember each one of those children today. We remember each one of those Jews. Horrific, tragic, sadistic, barbaric. We don't understand why the mysteries of the world. Elie Wiesel in Night describes the first night in Auschwitz when they didn't have enough place in the gas chamber, so they threw all the babies into the fire. And he saw a baby on the gallows, and the body was too light to die fast. And Elie Wiesel says, and he saw somebody else hanging on the gallows. And 50 years later, Rosh Hashanah edition 1997 in the New York Times, he said, it's time to make peace with God. Because what he wrote in Night, who else he saw hanging on the gallows? And he says, the reason I want to make peace with God is because my denial of you came because of my faith in you. You were supposed to be so close to us, why did you become so distant? Understand what Jewish atheism is like. So I finish reading the Kinnis and I say, wow, but we're here to tell the story. We carry their memories, we carry their genes, we carry their hearts, we carry their ideals. Where is Nevuzradon? Well, he converted, so maybe he's also around. Maybe his genes are also around, I don't know. I don't know about the genes of Nevuzradon. But that's very inspiring. How did Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai manage to do it? 4 words. Ten li yavna v'chachamel. And I'll tell you something. Tugdol Yisrael said the same thing. Rabbi Shimshon Rafal Hirsch in Germany and the Erz Sameach in Lithuania in Meshech Chachma. They both ask a great question. Why could you not take away the poles from the Aron? Lo yasuru habadim mimenu. Imagine your husband buys a Van Gogh. Anybody? $25 million. A Picasso, $3 million. Zalman Kleiman. Okay, $100,000. Maybe we can afford that. A beautiful painting, and it comes in a suitcase. It comes in a suitcase. Gewaldic, it's insured. And you hang it up in your salon, in your beautiful new living room that you built in Muncie, for all the feinschmeckers to come to your house and go, I can. And you right away make sure to make a simcha, so everybody should get jealous in the kishkas, everybody should come visit, etc. And you hang up the beautiful painting and you leave the suitcase right there. And your wife says, why are you leaving the suitcase? You say, because you want to move in 2 years when you find a nicer house. So he says, put the suitcase in storage. When we move, we take out the suitcase. You have an Aron, with the luchas, you have two poles, the pasnish. 369 years in Shiloh. Take off the poles, put it in storage. When you have to move, you put back the poles. The menorah didn't have poles attached to shulchan. Didn't have, when they needed to move, they were in one place for 18 years. Why have two sticks? The pasnish, that's not nice. Take it away, put it away when you have to move it. Put the sticks back. Lo yasuru abadim imenu, the Rambam says, Isser Malkus. You get Malkus for taking away the poles. The Steingen in Yiddish. The staves in English. Why? The Meshech Chachma and the Ur Sameach both give an answer. I'll explain to you their answer, but always through a story. So again, ADDs, we're next subject, don't worry. Next subject, we're off, don't worry. You don't have to listen to Meshech Chachma now. I know you heard one Friday night probably from the rabbi. Here's the problem, okay? The British Queen is vacationing in Germany. She's supposed to be there for a few weeks. It's evening time and she feels like she's going to give birth prematurely. You know the problem? Problem is, if the Crown Prince is not born on British soil, if he's born in another territory, he can't be there. You remember Trump with Obama's birth certificate? We're not going to go there at the moment, but you remember the Maisa. That's why they love each other so profoundly. There's an extra love between those two. But I don't want to contradict my Chafetz Chaim speech, so we won't do it. So, what do you do? Moshe Montefiore is the British guy. He travels with the royal entourage. He takes a break. He goes to Minchemayriv in Hanover, Germany. Who's the Rav of Hanover? Rav Nosson Adler. What do you do between Minchemayriv? What do Jews do? They solve the problems of the world, just like they do in Mumsi between Minchemayriv. Here, actually, they don't take a break because plague. But usually, Jews take a break between Minchemayriv, so they solve the problems of the world. So Moshe Montefiore is schmoozing and he says, there's a crisis. Nosson Adler says, what's the crisis? He says, the queen is about to give birth and it's going to be a tzara tzrura. The guy's going to be born here. He won't be able to become the king. A tragedia in the Welt. Nosson Adler says, let me tell you what to do. You take a big boat. You put her on the boat with the doctors. You go 3 miles out into the sea. It's international waters. This law doesn't apply to international waters. If he's born in international waters, British can claim it and he can become the crown prince. Rabbeisa, Ayyidishakup? Kachava. They took the queen into the ocean. She gives birth 3 miles into the sea, Hanover, Germany port. He can become the crown prince. And that's why he creates the chief rabbinate in England. And Rabbi Adler is the first chief rabbi, of which Rabbi Sachs recently retired. And Rabbi Mervis took over. You see, Jews have an expertise in how to maintain identity on foreign soil. So in 1989, the Dalai Lama, you know who the Dalai Lama is? Yeshiva Shadeim, summons 10 Jews to find out how the Buddhists are supposed to survive on foreign soil. They have been exiled from Tibet in 1959. He says we're 50, 60 years on different soil. We're not in our place anymore. We have been exiled by the Chinese. We're in India. How can I inspire the next generation? He calls Jews to find out how you remain a people on foreign soil. Roger Kamenetz writes up the whole conversation, A Jew in the Lotus. Unfortunately, Lafi Daiti, they answered him, Narishkeit. So I'm going to tell you what I would have answered the Dalai Lama if he would have asked me. He didn't. But every Jew has the speech that he would have said had he been asked, just like he has the building he would have bought if not for his shviger who dissuaded him. He could have bought it for $9 and today he would have been richer than Buffett. Can you do aliyadim? The answer is the Meshech Chachma and Abshimshin of Fall Hirsch. You know why the poles were always by the Oren? To give the Jews a message. And the message was as this. You see this Oren? This Aron is in Kodesh HaKadoshim. This Kodesh HaKadoshim is in the Beis HaMikdash. This Beis HaMikdash is on the Harabayas. This Harabayas is in Yerushalayim. This Yerushalayim is in Eretz Yisrael. This is your capital. This is your homeland. But you see there are poles. This is transport. As you will transport this ark with you, you will never really be exiled from your homeland. So Heinrich Heine, is a German poet who converts to Christianity, becomes a Protestant, Heinrich Heine, not because he loves Christianity, because he wanted to become a professor in university, imagine. And the Germans are telling him, you come from a people that doesn't even have a homeland. 1700s, there's no homeland. Palestine is under the Ottoman Empire, under the Turks, there's no homeland. And Heinrich Heine, the Meshumad, says to them, they do have a homeland. It's a portable homeland. It's called the Torah. It's a portable homeland. This is what the Meshech Chachmar and Shimshon Rafal Hirsch write. When a Jew in Krakow, a Jew in Sosnovitz, a Jew in Brod, a Jew in Galicia, a Jew in Romania, in Siget, in Hungary, a Jew in England, a Jew in New York, Brazil, New Zealand, Melbourne, Sydney, a Jew in Moscow, a Jew in Petersburg, or a Jew in a little shtetl in Ukraine, Mezhebuzh, Bardichev, or Zhytomyr, came home from a difficult day, and he opened up a Blat Gemara. Where was he? He was in Eretz Yisrael, in Yerushalayim, in Kadesh HaKadoshim, in the Aron. He opened up a Siman in Shulchan Aruch. He opened up a Sefer of Nigla, of Nister, of Halacha, of Rishonim, of Acharonim, of Poskim, of Torah Shebiksav, and Torah Shebalpa. The poles of the Aron were saying, this is always with you. You have a transportable homeland. That's what Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai understood. Ten li yavne v'chachameha. So he made Vespasian himself ultimately undermine Rome without realizing that by keeping Yavne alive, by definition, the Jew would never die because the Jew would become immortal through Mesechta Zvachim and Mesechta Menachos, through Mesechta Erevin and Mesechta Shkolim, through Yuma and Sukkah. And let's say something else as well. There's always a big conversation. I'm not going there right now. I know it's sensitive and controversial. I don't think it's so controversial, but it's a little sensitive. And that is, who built the modern state of Israel? You know, the modern state of Israel was not built by very, very religious Jews. Let's put it that way. It was not built by people who went to Daf Yomi every day. Some of them knew Daf Yomi ganz well, because they came from good chadarim, good yeshivas. But they chose another path. But let's understand something else. That is, of course, true. The state of Israel that was built in 48 was created as a secular democracy, allowing a tremendous, unprecedented blossoming of Torah and yeshivas in extraordinary ways. But the constitution is a liberal democracy. You all know that. With many ramifications and many consequences. Leos Amchavshi, which we're not going to get into right now. But I want to say one thing, and that is, do you think it would have been possible for Chaim Weizmann or David Ben-Gurion or Moshe Sharet and all of those early, or Zalman Rubashov, Zalman Shazar, and all of those early characters, even agnostics, atheists, socialists, left-wing liberals, and so forth, to even come back to something and rebuild it as they built it without 1900 years of Jews learning day in, day out about Eretz Yisrael and mentioning it 60 times a day in their davening? You think that if it was not for the Rambam and the Ravid arguing about Kedusha Rishoyim and Kedusha Shniya, if not for the Kesef Mishnah and the Lechem Mishnah arguing about Kedushas Kloyim and Kedushas Mechitzas, if not for the Beis Halevi and Reb Chaim writing Ma'arochas on Dine Kotchim, on Koraloi, Labila, Bila, Ma'akevis Boy, on Gedushas Mechitzis, on Pigul, on Noisa, on Ailocha, on Kabbalah, on Lashem Shishadvarim, Azevach Nizbach, on Lashma Bai Chatos, on Chatois Hamesis. You think of the Rishonim and the Acharonim and the Poskim from all of the walks and backgrounds for 2,000 years did not stay up nights to figure out. And the halachas of Maaser Sheni, and the halachas of Truma Gedoila, and the halachas of Challah, and the halachas of Tumas Meis, and all the halachas of the Karbonis daily and weekly and monthly in the Beis Hamikdash, and the halachas of Yom Kippur, and the halachas of Kodesh HaKadoshim, and Hilchas Aron, and Hilchas, etc., etc. There wouldn't even be where to come back to. There would be no people to go back to. There would be no memory of it. There would be no longing for it, no yearning for it. Who needs it? As somebody once said, a reporter, Israel is a great country, it's just in a very bad neighborhood. And it's true, and the neighborhood is bad, and it's getting worse from day to day, the neighborhood. How would it be able even to happen? Ah, if that's the case, we could give a verdict for Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai that he didn't go to the place opposite of Gan Eden. Maybe that's why Chizkiyah Melech Yehuda showed up. Who was Chizkiyah? Chizkiyah is the one man who actually saved Yerushalayim, because Sancheiriv came to conquer it, just like he exiled the 10 tribes. He was about to destroy Yerushalayim. Chizkiyah is the one who saved Yerushalayim. On his deathbed, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai asked the question, am I guilty for the destruction of Jerusalem or not? Who showed up? The man who saved Yerushalayim. Perhaps he was comforting Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai and telling him, not only are you not responsible for its destruction, you can take credit for its rebuilding. You know why? Because you said, Tendli Yavne v'chachame, it was the best you can do. And you did right. You did well. 2,000 years later, your children still have Yavne, they still have Chachame, and they're in Eretz Yisrael as well. In Galus, but so many, most Jews, Roiv Minyan, Roiv Binyan, today in Eretz Yisrael. And here there's a word, I say Tisha B'Av, what time is it? Ah. I tell you this, Shavuosai. This happened a few years ago. The city is Pietrzykow, Poland. You know who the Rav of Pietrzykow was? The Rav of Pietrzykow was Rav Meir Shapiro, the founder of Daf Yomi, and then he went to Lublin. In Lublin he made Yachil, built Yachil, Yeshivas Chacham in Lublin, he became the Rav of Lublin. Rav Meir Shapiro died without children. Zion Cheshvan Tafresh Tzadik Dalad, 1933. Right? Anybody here knows about Rav Meir Shapiro? Mela the Mayflower you don't know, but Rav Meir Shapiro at least. Okay. 1930, if I'm not mistaken, Cheshvan 1933, very young age, early 40s. Rav Meir Shapiro gave over his throne to another man, his first cousin. His cousin's name, Rabbi Moshe Chaim Lau. Moshe Chaim Lau was sent to Treblinka with his oldest son, Mulek Shmuel. In 1943, they were sent to the gas chambers in Treblinka. He still had two sons. He had Naftali Lavi, recently died, and the baby, Yisrael Meir Lau, who they called Lulek. Lulek stayed with his mother, but when it came the day, that 1944, they separated Naftali, who was a teenager, from mommy, and she had little Lulek, Yisrael Meir. She threw him away into his brother's hands and told her son to take care of him. He said he stood there and cried nonstop. His mother threw him away. Of course, it was the last time she saw him because she perished. And his brother took him into Buchenwald in a sack. And he survived. A 5-year-old kid survived the concentration camps. Rabbi Yisrael Meir Lau. His father told Naftali before he went to Treblinka, I am the 37th in a chain of rabbis. My father, 37th generation. Yisrael Meir will be the 38th. Keep an eye on him. He kept an eye on him. His older brother recently passed away in Eretz Yisrael. As you know, he became the chief rabbi of Israel in 1993. Tov Shin Nun Gimel. Rabbi Yisrael Meir Lau decided to go visit Pietrzykow as chief rabbi of Israel. He comes there for Shabbos. You know which Shabbos? Shabbos Chazoin, Tisha B'Av. Shabbos Chazoin, right before the fast day of Tisha B'Av. He goes to the shul where his father was rabbi, from where he was taken to Treblinka and Gaz with his brother. And his mother was killed. Most of the family was killed. He and his brother survived. Went by Shlomo Zalman and Kol Torah, learned in Ponovich, then became a rabbi of Netanya, Tel Aviv, chief rabbi. Rabbi Lau gives a sermon in Pietrzykow, Shabbos Chazoin Tisha B'Av, Erev Tisha B'Av. Now his father, Moshe Chaim Lau, was known as a great orator, great speaker. If you ever saw, his son looks like him actually, very impressive figure. Very royal figure he had. A little like Rav Meir Shapiro he looked, they were cousins. He was a great speaker like Rav Meir Shapiro was. Meir Shapiro was Rosh HaMadavrim in Poland. Moshe Chaim was killed young. And Rabbi Lau was a great orator as well, Tzolanga Yaron. He gets up and he's speaking at the pulpit of his father. But think about it. He's coming back as chief rabbi when his father was sent to Treblinka. Rabbi Lau quotes a medrash. The medrash is in Eicha, in the introduction to Eicha. It's from the medrashim that's learned every year by those who learn Eicha Rabba and Tisha B'Av, the minig by many. It's the medrash, the introduction to Eicha. And this is what the medrash says. When Avraham Avinu heard that the Beis HaMikdash is being destroyed, he came to the Ribbono Shel Olam and he said, this is why I sacrificed my life, that you should get rid of them. So Hashem said, Bonecha Chatu, your children sinned. Avraham Avinu said, prove it. Hashem said, the Torah will come to testify. The Sefer Torah came to testify that the Jews sinned. Amar Avraham la Sefer Torah. Avraham turned to the Sefer Torah, I quote the Medrash in English. Have you no shame, Sefer Torah? When God wanted to give you to the world, he went to every nation. Every nation said no. There was one nation that said yes, the Jewish people. Have you no shame to come today and speak out against them? They were the only ones who took you. What chutzpah do you have? And the Sefer Torah remained silent. And it told Hashem, my testimony is finished. So Avraham turns to God and said, prove that they sinned. The witness has been disqualified. So Hashem said, the letters of the Aleph Beis will testify that they sinned. Aleph comes along and starts speaking. Avraham interrupts the Aleph and says these words, have you no shame? The opening of Aseres HaDibris is Anoichi Hashem Elokecha. The only ones who would listen to the Ten Commandments are the Jews. And it started with your letter. Have you no shame? Nishtate ka'alef. The Aleph was quiet. The Beis came along. Avraham said, have you no shame? The opening of the Torah is with a Beis, Bereishis Bara. The only ones who care for the Torah are the Jews. How dare you? The Beis was quiet. The Gimel came. He said, how dare you? The mitzvah of tzitzis starts with a Gimel. Gdilim tasalach. In Parshas Ki Seitzeh, the only ones who care about tzitzis are the Jews. Have you no shame? The Gimel was quiet. The Medrash says, the Dalit said, I'm not even trying. And that was it. And that was it. The testimony was over. They were quiet. This is the Medrash Eicha Rabba. Rabbi Lau says, but I want to tell you something. I had a shver, his name was Rabbi Yedide Frankel, Rabbi of Tel Aviv, also a survivor. And I heard from him something else. That in Parshas HaZinu, Moshe Rabbeinu gets up and he says, "V'onsa Hashira Hazois La'ed." The song of HaZinu is going to be an eight kilos Yishokach Mipizarei. It won't be forgotten from its children. So everybody learns the pasuk that the Shira will always be able to be a witness because it will never disappear. He says, "My Shver said no." Moshe was arguing with Avraham Avinu. Moshe was arguing with Avraham Avinu. Made the letters be quiet. They're not going to say anything. Moshe said, no more, no Avraham. You don't know what's going to happen. Ki lois yishokach mi pizaroi. V'onsa ashira hazois leit ki lois yishokach mi pizaroi. Not only that the Torah and the Aleph Beis have to be silenced. They could bear witness that the Torah was never forgotten from its children. It's not only that you silence them so they shouldn't bear reverse witness, to bear opposite testimony against the Jews. Moshe told Avram, you will look at their history and you'll see that they will be the witnesses that it was never forgotten from the Jewish people. And right there he says, ask the letters of Aleph Beis, ask the Torah, the sacrifice that the Jews had in the camps to put on tefillin, to hear shofar, to eat kosher, to daven, to light Hanukkah candles, with the oil that they got from the little margarine or fahakta soup that they served them, which was more like mud. And they took a wick from the remnants of the fabric of their uniforms that they wore. And they lit Hanukkah candles under those conditions and many other such experiences. It's not just that the letters... It's not that the letters ought to be silent. The letters can testify for what the Jewish people did with Torah and Mitzvahs throughout the thousands of years in exile and dispersion. The poles of the Aryan, let them speak. Today they can speak. They can say with what love the Jewish people held on to it. He said, that's the sermon I want to give in Piotrkov today. The last sermon since my father. The first sermon since the last sermon that my father gave 1941 in Piotrkov. Now you'll understand the answer of the Chasam Sofer. You thought I forgot. Kol ha-mis'abel al Yerushalayim zoyche v'roye b'simchasu. So the Chasam Sofer fabulously points to a Medrash B'reishis Rabba Parsha Pei Dalet. Yosef is supposedly devoured by a wild beast. Taroif Taraf Yosef, Chayero Achalosum. Vayakumu Kolbano v'Cholbnoisav L'Nachamai. All Yaakov's children try to comfort him. Vayimoyin L'Isnachem. He refuses to be comforted. He says, I'm going to go down to the grave, mourning for Yosef, my son. Ask Chazal why. And Chazal tell us, Gzeirihi al hamesri yishtakech min alev avaloy alachai. Ribbono shel Olam made an edict in life that when somebody passes away, a person has the ability to move on. It's not easy. It's not easy, but a person somehow has the resilience to be able to open up a new chapter in life. It may take a year, it may take a few years, a person moves on. Not everybody, but usually. That's only if the person died. If the person is alive, they can't forget him. He's not dead. Yosef was alive. Yaakov could not move on. He's always mourning for him. Why? Because he's alive. And when he's alive, you can't forget. It's like those parents who lost children as a result of kidnappings. And for years, they can't do closure. There's no closure. Because you cannot say the person is dead. And you don't want to give up hope. And there's just no closure. You could never move on. The torment is unbelievable. Shemirach. Unbelievable. What such a parent goes through. Any parent who loses a child. But these are parents who are stuck, mamish, between the heart and the rock. Zaktich Sam Sofer. A normal nation gets exiled. 10 years, 50 years, 100 years, 200 years. You're a minority. You're not even 1%. You're not even 0.25%. You assimilate. You learn to live a new life. Everyone learns to adjust. Refugees, you learn to adjust if you're healthy, if you want to live. You move on, and that's how nations lose their identity. They assimilate. The question then is, what happened to the Jewish people? And the answer is, Kol ha-mis'abel al Yerushalayim. They're still mourning for Yerushalayim. How long could you mourn for something that died? You mourn for a year. You mourn for a few years. You mourn for a generation. You mourn for 5 generations. But 1,000 years passed. Move on. Shuvi, shuvi ha-shulamis. It's time to move on. Make a new life for yourself. And many Jews at some point felt it's time to make a new life, to create a new vision, to create a new future. How is it that every year Tisha B'Av, for more than almost 2,000 years, Jews come and all they're talking about is Yerushalayim. An Alter Beis HaMikdash that's not been around. People, I don't even remember what happened yesterday to me. Guy calls me the other day, he says, I want to continue the conversation from last week. I said, first of all, your name. Second of all, your address, they'll tell me the conversation. He was very insulted. He says, you say you have a good memory. I said, yeah, depends for what. You'll forgive me, I can't remember everything. I don't remember what I ate for breakfast today. Oh, there was no breakfast, I told you. I told you I can't remember what I ate for breakfast. People don't know anything. Ask a person what was said in the Shia last Monday. Who knows? Somebody once told me, Rabbi Jacobson, you speak a joke you could repeat once a year, a story once in 2 years, a Dvar Torah twice in the same sermon. It's not a problem. Amaisim at Yerushalayim, Yirmiya, Yeshaya, Yoshio, Chiskiya, Nevi'im, Bayis Rishon, Bayis Sheni. A lot of water has come under the bridge, friends. There's a new world order. We got new problems. We got new challenges. Ask the Chacham Sofer, where is this Misabala Yerushalayim? What's pshat? The answer is because it's not dead. It's alive. If it would have been dead, you move on. It's still alive. And Jews feel it's alive. The Beis HaMikdash is alive. Yerushalayim is alive. The Shechina is alive. The Jewish people are alive. Eretz Yisrael is alive. Torah is alive. If not in Gashmias and Ruchnias. That's pshat called HaMisabala Yerushalayim. Zoicha v'roya b'simchasa, says the Chacham Sofer. You're zoicha to see the simcha right now. The fact that there's Jews who are misabal al Yerushalayim, it means that they are seeing right now simchas Yerushalayim. That itself is the simcha. In the present tense, that's the simcha. The simcha is that it's alive. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai secured that. And because it's alive, therefore they're not stopping to be misabal. Because something that's alive doesn't disappear. And something that's alive becomes more alive. And therefore they know, Zoyche v'roya b'simchasa, both in present tense and in future tense, b'mheira b'yameinu, amen. Thank you.